Marty Moscoen, welcome to Radio Times. Iran's nuclear program is bound to be a topic of debate when the UN General Assembly meets this week. Iran says its program is a peaceful one, while critics contend it could destabilize the region and threaten Israel. Diplomatic efforts between Iran and the U.S., Britain, China, Russia, and Germany have come up short. Meanwhile, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has been putting pressure on the Obama administration to set a clear red line with Iran. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton said the U.S. is not setting deadlines and still supports negotiations and sanctions to stop Iran from developing nuclear weapons. Today on Radio Times, we look at the complex relationship between these three countries and their leaders. And we begin with Lourdes Garcia Navarro. She's NPR foreign correspondent based in Jerusalem, reports on the Middle East. And Lourdes, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Great to be here.
How worried are Israelis about an attack or a nuclear attack from Iran?
I think extremely concerned. I mean, there's no question, certainly from the Israeli perspective, that the Iranian threat is a real threat. This government, led by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, ever since it came into office, has made the Iranian threat first and foremost in its foreign policy. It's been credited by its supporters in really galvanizing world opinion against Iran and pushing for the very severe sanctions that Iran is now under. So when you speak to average Israelis on the street, they are certainly concerned about Iran's suspect nuclear program, and they do feel that it is a very present danger to them. Of course, the other side of this is exactly what to do about it, and that is the subject of a great deal of contention, as you mentioned.
Well, indeed, and tension between the U.S. and Israel. Lourdes, though, is there support in Israel for Israel to go ahead and attack Iran's nuclear facilities?
The population here is extremely divided. I mean, you know, it's one of the things that's when you're living here, you don't people from the outside don't often realize the robust debate that there is in this country about everything, and certainly about something as important as Iran. And what polls have consistently shown is a few things. First of all, they show that, yes, Israelis are very worried about Iran, but they are divided in what to do about it. On the one hand, they certainly support sanctions, but they don't trust in diplomacy. They don't believe that negotiations will go anywhere. But they don't overwhelmingly support a unilateral Israeli strike on Iran. There has been a lot of debate here, not only among the Israeli population, but certainly among the military, the intelligence services. Many people who have come out publicly in an unprecedented manner, from the defense minister to the president, saying that they do not support a unilateral strike on Iran without the U.S. being involved. And so that is one of the reasons why you might see Prime Minister Netanyahu putting so much pressure on the United States. The public does not feel that they can take on Iran by themselves. They know that they need the Americans, practically speaking, because they might not have the weaponry, and also because any unilateral strike on Iran will inevitably bring in the United States in some fashion. I mean, the United States has bases very close to Iran in many different countries that are very volatile, Afghanistan being one of them. And so clearly, Iran can inflict a lot of damages on U.S. assets. And so, you know, anything that Israel does will not just be something that Israel does by itself. It's something that will affect the region and affect the United States.
Let me quote something that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said earlier this month. He said, "Those in the international community who refuse to put red lines before Iran don't have a moral right to place a red line before Israel. I think Iran must understand that there's a red line so they stop advancing their program to produce atomic bombs." Was that, Lourdes, for domestic consumption, for international consumption?
It was for both. First of all, it is for, certainly the message was for the United States. I mean, by making that kind of public declaration, that statement was actually made in English at a press conference. It was not made in Hebrew. So it was clearly something that was meant to go all over the world and certainly be heard by the Obama administration, and it was. And that has been the cause of a great deal of contention here. But what does Prime Minister Netanyahu mean by red lines? Have the Israelis made clear what their red lines are? And if, for example, the Obama administration says that they will have a red line, what does it mean then? I mean, is it a countdown to a conflict? What are the repercussions? These are all very serious matters. And so that has been, you know, the subject of a great deal of debate. And as you know, we're in an election season in the United States, and so it's playing a lot of different ways. But, you know, by and large, Israelis are quite uncomfortable by the public pressure that Mr. Netanyahu has placed on the Obama administration, the feeling that somehow he is politicking in America, that this issue has become such a source of contention in the presidential elections. You know, they'd like to see a lower profile. They'd like to see these debates happen possibly behind closed doors.
Let me get Aaron David Miller to join our conversation. He's a public policy fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars and has been listening in. And Aaron David Miller, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Pleasure to be here.
You have described this relationship between Netanyahu and Obama as a really dysfunctional relationship. Do you think more dysfunctional than past leadership relationships between these two countries?
I mean, I think yes. I've watched this relationship since Begin and Sadat. And while there have been periods of tension, usually there have been enterprises that have emerged which have allowed a certain amount of cooperation, which has generated a capacity by each leader to give the other the benefit of the doubt. Carter and Begin were an example of that. Even Shamir and Bush 41, which was one among the most tense relationships, generated a certain measure of cooperation over the first Iraqi war and the Madrid Peace Conference. 4 years in, this pair is about as dysfunctional as I've seen.
But are you saying that the disagreements that they have should take place behind closed doors and not out in public?
Well, for sure, that's the case. And I think the Israelis have done a masterful job in focusing the international community on threat of Iran's developing the capacity to produce a weapon. But there's a real danger. And the prime minister has a habit of needlessly self-inflicted wounds. There's a danger of overplaying the hand. And I think you saw that in the public challenge on the issue of red lines. There's absolutely, and Lourdes is right, there's absolutely no reason to have a public debate or argument between two close allies over this thought experiment on red lines. They need a very detailed and private discussion of the question of military options, when, where, if, but not in public. Mm. And there was no reason, frankly, for the prime minister to challenge what the secretary said. It just makes no sense.
Let me get a third guest in on the conversation. This is Mehdi Kalaji, and he's a senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, has also been listening in. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Pleasure to be with you.
And looking at this very public disagreement between Netanyahu and Obama, do you think that Iran sees this as something that is, in a sense, helps Iran while they watch these two allies fight with each other?
Obviously, Iran is very happy to see this fundamental disagreement and public disagreement between United States and Israel over Iran's nuclear program. And watching and listening to Iranian leaders' statements, you would conclude that Iranian leaders do not believe that anything substantial would happen before a U.S. Presidential election, neither a military attack nor a significant progress in the negotiation. They are waiting for the post-election period, and they believe that even after the election, whether Obama gets reelected or Romney gets elected, neither of them would be willing to attack Iran. They have to come up with a new set of offers which would be much more incentive to Iranian leaders than before. So they are waiting, they are watching, and they believe that attacking Iran unilaterally would be very costly for Israel and Israeli military elite, as well as a great deal of the public opinion cannot accept this. And in terms of United States, they think that United States is not politically able to afford such an attack before the presidential election.
Lourdes, does that make sense to you?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's exactly the situation. And certainly that's one of the issues here at the moment, because so much has been made of Prime Minister Netanyahu's involvement and public declarations and the perception that somehow he's aligned to the Republicans in the United States, that he wants Romney to win, and because the Republican Party has made so much of its special relationship with Israel, he is now kind of in a quandary, if you will, that if he was to make some sort of unilateral move, it would be perceived in some quarters as having a political motive, as opposed to you know, the motive that he always purports is the reason behind all of this, which is fear for his country and fear that Iran is trying to develop a nuclear weapon.
Lourdes, we have to say goodbye to you in a couple of moments here, or a couple of minutes, I should say. But I'm wondering how, looking at Israel's neighbors, you've got Syria, you've got Lebanon, you've got Egypt, you've got the remnants of the Arab uprising. You also have the fallout from this crude video that was made in the U.S. Has that added to tensions within Israel?
Certainly. I mean, you know, at the moment, not only does Israel feel that its focus is all on Iran, but it finds itself in a region in upheaval. It doesn't know what the future of the peace treaty with Egypt will be. It sees Syria up in flames, destabilization also in Lebanon, possibly. And the peace process is at a complete and utter standstill. And you have the Palestinian Authority looking like it's on its last legs almost, because of a huge financial crisis and a political crisis, actually, that has come out of that. So, you know, the situation is extremely tense at the moment. But, you know, the Prime Minister really is focusing all of his attention on Iran. I mean, if you listen to him and his comments, those discussions get less shrift here than the subject of Iran. And that is really where he's focusing all of his pressure and all of his international attention.
Lourdes, just you had a very disturbing but fascinating piece about life in Gaza and how quality of life has fallen precipitously in Gaza.
That's right. I mean, as all of this happens and we look around the region at all of the conflicts that happen here, of course, the, you know, Israeli-Palestinian issue has fallen by the wayside, and it is a great lament to the Palestinians. Not only the situation in the West Bank, where settlements are expanding and you see a lot of things, but also in Gaza.
Right. Well, we thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
You're welcome.
And that's Lourdes Garcia-Navarro, NPR foreign correspondent. She's based in Jerusalem and reports on the Middle East. We're going to take a very short break and then continue our conversation with Aaron David Miller, public policy fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. And from 1978 to 2003, he served at the Department of State as an advisor to six secretaries of state on U.S. policy in the Middle East. We will also continue our conversation with Mehdi Kalaji, and he's a senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, was born in Iran, studied theology there, was on editorial boards of two prominent Iranian periodicals produced for the BBC, as well as the U.S. government's Persian News Service. We'll continue our conversation looking at this complicated relationship between the U.S., Israel, and Iran. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Resident Ensemble Players, Delaware's professional acting company in residence at the University of Delaware, supports WHYY. The Rep offers the work and words of master storytellers and presents Connor McPherson's The Weir, September 27th through October 14th. A few mates gather at a pub in Ireland for pints and a spooky story or two. When a pretty stranger joins them, her tale becomes the most eerie and unnerving of all. For tickets, 302-831-2204 or DelawareRep.org.
I'm Mike and Scott. Listener support is vital to WHYY, and we'll be asking for yours during our upcoming membership campaign. But the October buyback is your chance to help give us a head start. Make a pledge during our October buyback, and for every 750 donations we receive, you'll buy back one day. This means one less day of pledge and one more day of news without membership breaks. Do your part at whyy.org/support. Thank you.
Supporting WHYY, Lantern Theatre Company presents a limited return engagement of New Jerusalem, The Interrogation of Baruch de Spinoza at Talmud Torah Congregation, Amsterdam, July 27, 1656, extended through September 30th. Based on true events in the life of one of history's great thinkers, David Ives' engaging drama challenges traditional political and religious thinking with conviction, passion, and wit. Tickets and information online at lanterntheater.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. We're talking about the debate, the rhetoric over Iran's nuclear program, and has intensified over the last couple of months, revealing tensions between the U.S. and Israel. And again, our guests are Aaron David Miller and Mehdi Kalaji. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Aaron David Miller, do you think Iran wants a nuclear weapons program? They say they're building these facilities for peaceful purposes. Is that credible?
I mean, look, you have 9 countries in the world today that have deliverable nuclear weapons. You have 5 permanent members of the Security Council, the Brits, the French, the Chinese, the Russians, and the United States. And you've got 4 additional powers, North Korea, India, Pakistan, and Israel. All of those 4 have developed nuclear weapons since 1970. So it isn't a large group. But what unites all of them, even though they're all different, I think, is a profound sense of insecurity. Some also have a profound sense of grandiosity. But Iran seems to me to be the poster child for the marriage of insecurity and grandiosity. If the Shah had not been overthrown by Khomeini in 1979, Iran would have already been a nuclear weapon state. So, in my judgment, let's distinguish between the weapons program, the so-called capacity, and the weapon itself. I think, and again, I'll defer to Mehdi on this, it is essentially an Iranian national interest for many reasons to develop the capacity to produce a weapon and to give Iran the possibility of breaking out within a 6 to 8 to a year period to actually weaponize. Whether they choose to do that is another matter.
Well, picking up on that, Mehdi Kalaji, do you see it developing this technology, even this weaponry, for offensive or defensive reasons?
Yes. Let me remind you a famous quote from Kissinger. Once he said that Iran has all reasons to develop a nuclear weapon, and we have all reasons to stop him from acquiring a nuclear weapon. Look, the problem with Iranian regime is not only its ambition to get nuclear bomb. The problem with Iran started since Revolution 1979, and anti-Western, anti-modernity, anti-American stance of this regime became the main pillar of its ideology. So if you listen to Ayatollah Khamenei, the supreme leader of Islamic Republic, he says that we can compromise on many things, but we cannot compromise over our hostility toward the United States. So Iran, with nuclear bomb or without nuclear bomb, is doing its best to threaten the interest of United States and its allies in the region. We have seen a long history of Iran's involvement in terrorist operation and activities in the region and outside the region. So acquiring a bomb for such a government would be extremely dangerous, not only for United States and Israel, but also for other countries in the region, and also it would encourage Arab countries like Saudi Arabia and Egypt and even Emirates to pursue a weaponized nuclear program. Because if you talk with Arab countries, they do believe that the purpose of this Iranian nuclear program is not Israel. The target is not Israel, but it's Arab countries. They are extremely fearful about Iran's regional ambition. They are against Iran's involvement in Iraq, in Syria. So we're going to have a big problem in the region just because Iran wants to get nuclear bomb.
Aaron, just picking up on that, the Obama administration says it still believes in diplomacy and in sanctions, and doesn't want Iran to develop nuclear weapons. What other weapons does the U.S. have besides a strike in order to prevent Iran from developing this technology?
Look, in my judgment, the reality is there's only one country that can prevent Iran from acquiring the capacity to produce a weapon or the weapon itself, and that is the Iranians. Mm. Should they themselves determine that the costs of acquisition are simply too high, and frankly, the instruments at the disposal of the West, led by the United States and the P5 plus one, five members of the Security Council plus Germany, to either offer sufficient incentives or disincentives has simply not retarded or delayed or, in my judgment, you know, recalibrated Iran's determination. And I don't think there is any rational man or woman that you could talk to today who could tell you right now how this is going to end. If negotiations don't work, mm-hmm. and sanctions cannot work, then you create a situation where you have drift, and drift raises the possibility, however bad the risk-to-return ratio is, by the way, certainly on an Israeli unilateral strike, and even on an American military option, raises the possibility that not in 2012, but in 2013, there will come a decision point, either by Israel or the United States.
Let me ask you, though, we read about Stuxnet, some of these computer viruses, also some mysterious deaths of nuclear scientists, some targeted killings. Do you think, Aaron, that there is a kind of a covert, not war, but a covert attack on Iran's nuclear capabilities?
Well, I'm no longer in the... I worked for many years as an intelligence analyst. I'm no longer in the business. I read the newspapers, right. You know, just like you do, Marty. But the reality is that what you have right now is a cold war between Israel and the United States and Iran, implying all kinds of techniques to retard and delay the program. And as risky as that cold war is, it is a better alternative than a hot war.
How hurtful or harmful have been the sanctions that have been imposed on Iran, on the Iranian people?
Look, Iran has resumed its nuclear program in the mid 1980s. So if you look at the history of nuclear programs in the world, it's perhaps the longest nuclear process that we have seen in the history. So why such a delay has happened in Iran's nuclear program, and if Iran had no problem purchasing the nuclear technology and going through this process, Iran should have acquired the nuclear capability much, much earlier. I think this is because of international pressure. This is because of sanctions. This is because of United States and its allies' pressure on Iran to make its program transparent. So I do not believe that sanctions were useless. Nobody expected, I mean, people who have imposed sanctions did not expect that the sanction would immediately stop Iran's nuclear program. Nobody expected that the sanctions would immediately change the process of decision-making in Tehran. But they expected delay. They expected to open the doors of negotiation to Iran as they are pressuring Iran to make its program meet the standard conditions and NPT's requirements. Mm. So let me tell you, what we see now in Tehran is a high inflation rate. We see the rising of the price of all basic needs. We see the housing, the stagnation in the housing market. We see people are fearful about the uncertain about the future, near future. These are the impacts of sanctions. And as we go on, I think the sanctions would have more effect. And I personally, my personal prediction is that in 2013, that would not be a year for war. That would be a year for compromise, because Iran is running out of cash. Iran has saved a lot of money during this rise of the oil price in recent years, but they don't have cash that much. They would lose their ability to sell the oil cheaper than the international price, and they lose their ability to bypass the sanction much more than before. Already we see this tension within the political elite over the nuclear policy. And this is one of the main effect of the sanction, to widen the cleavage between two or various factions of the government and make sanction not only an economic pressure on the government, but also a political pressure. And I think the fruits of sanction to be seen.
Okay, fair enough. Let me just jump in here, because I do need to reintroduce you both, and that's Mehdi Kalaji, and he is a senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Also with us, Aaron David Miller, public policy fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. We're talking about the tensions between Iran, Israel, and the U.S., the complicated relationship between these three countries, and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Interesting, Aaron. Mehdi was talking about he feels that the sanctions will put pressure on Iran next year to compromise on this issue. You have a different scenario as you look at 2013.
No, not necessarily. I just think that the best outcome clearly would be a negotiated settlement. It's just that over time, that's proven to be extremely difficult. I mean, do you do a narrow deal on the issue of enrichment in which you concede the principle of enrichment, but it's somehow constrained or curtailed? Or do you do a grand bargain in which the nuclear issue is somehow part of a broader rapprochement? Because remember, as Mehdi put it so well, even without the nuclear issue, Iran and its determination to use its hostility toward the United States, and particularly to Israel, as a mobilizing, generating factor of legitimacy, is still a serious problem. Hamas, Lebanon, the emerging and looming Shia-Sunni Cold War, all of these things provide fertile opportunities for an Iranian government that considers itself a great power and would like to expand its influence. So if you can get a deal, either a narrow deal, technical deal on the issue of enrichment or the broader rapprochement, it's absolutely worth a try.
Well, let me get Paul from Fairmount to join our conversation on Radio Times. And Paul, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I have a simple question that I think probably a lot of people are wondering about. Someone has to ask it. Doesn't the refusal of the United States to recognize that Israel has nuclear weapons, not just a program, but has nuclear weapons, doesn't that complicate or perhaps even compromise the American diplomacy, any diplomacy in this effort, as it does all of American diplomacy in the Mideast? But I think particularly in this effort, I'm wondering, in particular, since Mr. Miller has taken part in some of this, as I understand his credentials. So that's my question. How does the American refusal complicate this, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Fair question. Aaron David Miller, go ahead.
Look, let's be clear. One of the elements of the job description of a great power is the capacity, luxury, even though while it may seem hypocritical, to behave in contradictory and even hypocritical fashion. The United States simply does not relate to Israel's possession of a weapon, which it will not acknowledge. Either will the Israelis, for that matter, even though it's clear the Israelis probably have at least 200-plus deliverable nuclear weapons of varying character. The United States is not going to treat the Israelis the same as it relates to North Korea or Pakistan. The closest, perhaps, is India, with which the United States wants to develop a much closer relationship. So Israel is going to get a pass, and the United States is going to look at the Israeli possession of a weapon in a far different manner. So does it complicate it? Yeah. Does it set the United States up for charges of double standards and hypocrisy? Absolutely. And you'll be hearing more from President Morsi, I'm sure, of Egypt on this matter during his own speech at the UN General Assembly. But it is a reality, and I'm not sure, given Israel's security needs and requirements, that that reality is going to change.
What do you think, Makhti Kalaji?
I think the problem with nuclear program is something, and problem with the nature of those regime is something else. Look, Mr. Miller rightly mentioned the history of Iranian nuclear program. Shah was as ambitious as Ayatollah Khamenei in at least acquiring nuclear capability. But the problem is that you are dealing with a government that constantly and publicly threaten the interest of United States and its allies, and also believes that the state of Israel should be actually wiped off the map. This is something really scary, you know, having such ambitions combined with such a radical ideology really makes Iran different than other countries.
Because they at least have said that they are willing to use these weapons if and once they get them?
Look, I don't think that I tend to believe that Iranian leaders are rational and they are not suicidal. It means that they don't use, if they have nuclear bombs some days, they wouldn't use it against any country, including Israel. But do not forget that you are dealing with a dictatorship. In dictatorship, the decision-making process is very obscure, and usually the decisions are made by a very few people, and it's not transparent, it's not democratic, and it's exposed to, is susceptible to many, many miscalculations. So, yes, Ayatollah Khamenei, I think, wouldn't make any conscious, deliberate decision to destroy Israel by nuclear weapon, because that would have lots of ramification for Iran, and that would be suicidal. But it doesn't make him immune from lots of miscalculation, as he has made in the past. Look at how he handled 2009 election inside the country. Look at how they run the economy. Look at many, many other mistakes they have done. Look at what they have done last year in attacking British embassy in Tehran. That was neither rational nor ideologically justifiable. So
you know, I got to stop here only because we're almost up in a break. And talking about Iran, Israel, and the U.S. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY, recipient of 10 Oscars, the most awarded to a musical. West Side Story will be projected on a giant screen at the Kimmel Center as the Philadelphia Orchestra performs the music live. Tickets at philorg.org and at 215-893-1999. October 5th, 6th, and 7th at the Kimmel Center, the movie and the music, West Side Story with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
Look at a congressional map of Texas, and you'll see some funny shapes, like the 27th District in South Texas.
It's shaped like a Glock pistol.
On the next Fresh Air, journalist Robert Draper tells us about redrawing congressional boundaries and how Republicans made the most of their gains in the 2010 elections. Draper writes about it in The Atlantic magazine. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY. Journalist Judith Warner set out to document a growing push by parents and doctors who frivolously medicate children in the name of conformity and achievement. Instead, she found the controversy of the over-medicated child is much more complicated than reductionist thinking. On the next Voices in the Family, Dan Gottlieb talks with Warner and others about choices families make about kids and meds when mental health issues arise. Today at noon, here on WHYY-FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. President Obama, Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu, Iran's President Ahmadinejad are all addressing the UN General Assembly this week. There is debate over Iran's nuclear program. It has intensified and revealed tensions between the U.S. and Israel. We're looking at the complex relationship between these three countries. And Aaron David Miller is our guest. He has advised six presidents on the Middle East and is with the Woodrow Wilson Center for Scholars. And Mehdi Kalaji, also with us, was born in Iran, worked as a journalist, and is with the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Aaron David Miller, since you have advised six presidents, do you find it unusual that Prime Minister Netanyahu in Israel seems to be so overtly supporting Mitt Romney?
Look, the great, open secret is that Israelis and Americans have been interceding in one another's politics for years. I mean, I worked for Bill Clinton, for George Bush 41, and there's no question that both of these presidents had preferred Israeli prime ministers that they would have liked to have seen in power. I mean, Bill Clinton went to extreme lengths in the spring of 1996 to intercede in a way that would have strengthened Shimon Peres's prospects of defeating Netanyahu. And Bush 41 clearly had problems with Yitzhak Shamir, and over housing loan guarantees probably contributed to Shamir's defeat at the hands of Rabin in 1992. So this notion that we don't intercede is ridiculous. But the problem for the prime minister is that the intervention, and I'm not sure that's what it is, if he is trying to corner the president by blustering on red lines within 50 days of a U.S. election, he's not going to succeed. And he's going to create the kind of backlash. If Benjamin Netanyahu really does prefer Mitt Romney as president, and I suspect he does, the worst outcome than having Barack Obama reelected is having an angry Barack Obama reelected. And I suspect he's already accomplished that.
Well, let me get some more callers in the conversation at 1-888-477-9499. We have Saeed from Harrisburg joining us. And go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Good morning. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just want to stress one point. As a Sunni, the Vindam is Sunni, I don't think the focus is Israel. It's Iran. Israel's main focus is to deflect attention from what's happening in Gaza. That's the whole point here. They want to just quiet the international community so that they can do whatever to, like the Saudis say, if you cut off the head of the snake dies. So what they want to do is just get Iran out of the way, just like Iraq, so that they can focus on, you know, completely taking over Gaza. That's the whole idea. I don't think they're worried about nuclear weapons with Iran. Iran is not going to attack anybody. As soon as I know that. And the Saudis are the worst people you can think of, even though my family is from there, because what they do is hypocrisy.
Well, Saeed,
either with Iran or Israel, based on what they can keep their family in power for. That's all it is about. It's nothing about nuclear weapons at all.
Okay, well, fair enough. Let me give Mehdi Kalaji a chance to respond to that. And he mentioned Saudi Arabia. You referenced concerns in the Middle East, even beyond Israel. Go ahead.
Yes, there is, we know, as
there is Mr. Miller called a Cold War between United States and Iran, there is also a Cold War between Iran and Saudi Arabia. And they are fighting against each other on many levels. We know that Saudi Arabia is supporting some armed group in the province of Balochistan who are fighting with Iranian regime, and also Iran is supporting some armed group in north of Yemen, the Houthi group. We know the support of Iran to many Shiite group in Bahrain and also in the eastern province of Saudi Arabia, and in return we know many support coming to Sunni groups in Afghanistan, in Pakistan, from Saudi Arabia. So both, I think there are three major power, is Muslim power in the region, Iran, Turkey, and Saudi Arabia, who have ambition for a hegemony over the region. And they see each other as each other supremacy as a threat. So we see this cold the worsening of the relationship between Iran and even Turkey in recent months over Syria. They have extremely two sets, different sets of interest in Syria and elsewhere. But let me go back to the question of presidential election.
Yeah, just briefly, if you don't mind, only because I'm watching the clock here. But go ahead.
This is really interesting that even Iranian regime seems to be interested in Romney to get elected as the president of United States, because they believe that Democrats traditionally and historically they had nice gestures and soft words, but in practice they went harsher on Iran. These were Democrats who have imposed the sanctions on Iran, and President Obama has imposed unprecedented sanctions on Iran. While the Republicans, for this is what Iranians perceive, I'm not saying that this is right or wrong, but Iranians believe that Republicans usually have very aggressive rhetoric, but in practice they are much easier to deal with.
Interesting. Aaron David Miller, do you see it that way, as someone who's worked with Republican and Democratic presidents and secretaries of state?
You know, on the issue of Iran, I'm not at all sure. I think this president, our current president, has an inclination to want to engage still, even though the first several years brought little benefit from that policy. And it may well be, back to Matthew's point, that freed from political and electoral constraints, they may go into this administration, if it should be reelected, may go into a more intense approach on diplomacy to try to offer additional incentives to try to get the Iranians to stand down from weaponization.
Let me see what Kirk from Furlong has to say. And Kirk, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello, Marty. Okay. Thank you for taking the call.
You're
and,
very welcome.
And I have the time is short, so this is a question for your guests.
Sure.
Assuming for the moment that the Iranians gained atomic weaponry, what, in their opinion, would be the percentage of likelihood that that capacity would be made available to Hezbollah?
It's a good question, Kirk. And Mehdi, let me put that to you.
This is one of the main concerns, and this is the one of the main reasons that the United States and its allies should put all efforts to stop Iran from acquiring a nuclear bomb, because Iran has explicitly already said that this country would export nuclear technology to other Muslim countries and Islamic groups. This is what Mr. President Ahmadinejad said many, many times. And obviously, one of the allies of Iran is Hezbollah. And the main concern is not that Hezbollah would use such a bomb against Israel. The main concern is that even having such a bomb would change the whole political equation in the region against Israel, against United States, and against its, against West.
Kirk, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Aaron David Miller, let me ask you a bit about the Arab Spring. It's been almost, I guess, 2 years from the start of that spring. We, of course, are seeing changes across the Middle East and even parts of North Africa as well. What does that say, I guess, about the influence or perhaps even the lack of influence of the United States in this region?
Well, look, the good news is that for the first time in their modern history, the Arabs own their own politics. The fact that these changes occurred not in response to, as in Iraq, an external American military operation, but were a result of indigenous forces with Arabs, Muslims out in the streets, again, trying to own their own politics without reference to the United States or Israel, I think is a good sign. The problem is democracy is is something that is very difficult to produce. Since 1950, only 22 countries in the world have maintained their democratic character continuously. Neither India nor Turkey, that are democratic polities today, are belong to that club because during the 1970s, for a brief period, they both interfered with the democratic process. So the arc on change in this part of the world, gender equality, transparency, accountability, this is going to be a very long arc. And in the interim, things are going to get much worse for the United States as the political space available to us begins to shrink in this region. You see it already with Egypt.
You have said that the U.S. is the Rodney Dangerfield of the Middle East.
Yes, we are.
Meaning we don't get no respect.
Well, look, everybody, just about everybody, says no to the United States without cost or without consequence. Hamid Karzai says no. Nour al-Maliki says no in Iraq. Benjamin Netanyahu says no. Mahmoud Abbas says no. Mohamed Morsi says no. Vladimir Putin makes a habit of saying no. And I think we have lost an enormous amount of street credibility. But look, the reality is this, in my judgment. I've never believed since leaving government, and my views have changed, that this is a land of opportunity. This is a broken, angry, dysfunctional region. There is hope that over time it will change, but we are stuck like some modern-day Gulliver wandering around in a region that we don't understand, tied up by our own illusions and by tiny tribes whose interests very often are not our own, in a region we cannot fix and we cannot leave. And therein lies the cruel dilemma for a great power. I'm not a declinist. I would only say, Marty, one final thing. We need to pick our spots from now on very carefully. When we decide to project our military and political influence, we have to do it on the basis of what really is in our national interest.
Do you agree with that, Mehdi Kalaj?
Yes, I do agree with Mr. Miller. But let me tell you something else. As Mr. Miller rightly mentioned, this is a broken region. The fact that the United States is not popular on the streets of Arab countries, it doesn't mean that United States adversaries are popular. What we see is a significant decline of Islamic Republic legitimacy, ideological legitimacy, in the eyes of Muslims around the world. When Muslims come to power in Tunisia or in Egypt, they have to explicitly reassure their nation that they are not following the example of Islamic Republic. They don't want to create another Khomeini government in their country. This is very significant. So, along with the unpopularity of United States, which I believe it's it would disappear in long term. What I see is the failure of Islamic ideology and the failure of Islamic Republic of Iran as an example for Muslim world, and we should take this into consideration too.
Well, let me see what Tim from Belmead, New Jersey has to say. And Tim, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, hi. First of all, I served twice in Afghanistan and once in Iraq, so I have some experience with the Middle East. And I would say, without hesitation, Iran is going to get a nuclear weapon one way or the other. They're either going to buy it, because they're making a lot of money. I disagree with your guest. They're making a lot of money with a barrel of oil, $100 a barrel. They have the second largest oil reserve in the Middle East. So they're going to buy it either from North Korea or they're going to develop it. But one way or the other, they're going to have it. And I don't understand why we make a big deal out of that, because Pakistan has it and they don't like us. India has it. They do like us. There's a lot of other countries that have it, and Iran is going to have it. So I don't even understand why we go out of our way with sanctions, which don't necessarily work, and waste our breath thinking that they're not going to get it. Ahmadinejad, he is going to get it one way or the other. They just signed an agreement with North Korea. So they're going to buy the technology from them, or they're going to develop it themselves, but they're going to get it.
Tim, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me give Aaron David Miller a chance to respond. Go ahead.
Well, I think agree that the odds are that if the Iranians want it, they are going to develop it. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't try to prevent it. This is not the same situation as existed with the former Soviet Union, where for a 60-year period, only once, for 12 very scary days in October 1962, did these two countries face the real possibility of a nuclear exchange and the destruction, frankly, of much of the world as we know it. And since that time, because of the severity of the risk, former Soviet Union, United States, developed all sorts of procedures to preempt and prevent such an eventuality. This is not the case in this region. The U.S. and the former Soviet Union do not call the shots here. You are dealing with countries that believe this is an existential problem and that their physical survival is at stake. And in that kind of situation, the fewer countries that have nuclear weapons, the better off we're all going
to
be.
Well, on that note, my thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Aaron David Miller, thank you very much.
Pleasure.
And he's public policy fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. And Mehdi Kalaji, thank you very much as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome. He's a senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. And we began our conversation with Lourdes Garcia Navarro, NPR foreign correspondent based in Jerusalem and reports on the Middle East. Appreciate those phone calls. You can also go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about this program. I'm Marty Moscone. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour. Stay with us. We'll be right back.